Welcome to Polycast, an official podcast of the Polyton Civilization site.
Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Cardamandua. With guest co-host...
Grandpa Troll.
Dan, you sound faint.
Faint?
Yeah.
Let's see here.
I do mouth-to-mouth, that'll help. Welcome to Polycast and an official podcast of a Polyton civilization site. We have, of course, the founder of Polycast, Dan Quick, and we also have Annalee Katmandua. Welcome. We have Imran and Maka. I'm sorry, ma'am. I apologize. I have looked at your name for years. Makahua?
Makalua.
Makalua. And yours truly, Grandpa, are really not that bad troll.
In today's news, we turn temporarily back into Civ RevCast to talk about Civ Rev at the New York Comic Convention and about release date changes.
Before Tom, today we talked about the benefits of exploring after initial expansion and also enabling wineries.
The Senate, courthouses, and are they worth it? And also we had how are paratroopers useful?
Featured once again in the interview was Bruce Beta Hines, concluding his two-part interview on the Civilization IV Beyond the Sword Team Democracy game, whose start is all but imminent.
In the research lab, we look at a suggestion to make colonies more sensible, seed military control. Here's what's been making news in the Civ community.
Three previews for Civ Rev from Comic-Con, two on PlayStation 3 and one on the Xbox 360. The first one by Nate Ahern over at IGN talks about being shown the demo of the game. We knew that a demo for Civ Rev was coming about, so it looks like it's pretty well ready, but this is the demo that's also going to be released to the public. Then we now know that two of the 16 civilizations are available for play, the Romans with Caesar and Cleopatra of the Egyptians. Nate says he was still able to get a solid feel for the mechanics of the game with the demo. My favorite aspect of Civilization Revolution was easily the visual style, which kept the main theme of presenting an inviting game. And Civ Rev looks to finally bring a worthy addition to the Civ series home to consoles in a superbly reimagined form.
I cut my teeth on my son's PlayStation playing Civ 2. And the first time I played it, I think I played it 13 straight hours. I played my first game. I never played it before. And I restarted after an hour because I saw where I'd made mistakes. And I continued to play it. And I personally, I think it's a give and take. And I really think the screenshot kind of, to me, is an exciting view of it and what you can do with some of these options. I think it's going to be a big hit. I really do. And I say to those folks who kind of bash it because they call it dumbed down or simplified, I really think it's going to have its attributes as well.
In related news, release date changes. This is probably the biggest news for Civ Rev, is that if you're in Canada or the United States, you will not be able to play the full version of Civ Rev until a month after those in Europe. It says, for players in the US and Canada, this is from 2K, we are going to take this extra time to make your launch of Civilization Revolution even more awesome than initially planned. We have a lot of things up our sleeve to tide you over. Some exclusive multiplayer tournaments for US and Canadian players. They will run off the Civilization multiplayer demo. Perks for the winners of these contests are still being worked out, but those who are victorious can expect to get some limited edition Civ Rev swag, cash prizes, and a lucky few will face off against the teams at 2K and Firaxis.
So in other words, Europe gets to be the bug testers for us.
Oh, well, that's true.
I'd be a lot more excited if it was coming out on a decent platform. I'm not going to buy PS3 or the 360 or some crappy thing like that. And...
Oh! Wait a minute. I'm sorry. Somebody threw a rock in my pond.
Whoa! Cardamando has just declared war on Civ Rev.
Oh, she declared war on me!
Invade!
No, I think that Civ Rev would be... very cool on my Wii. However, they're not bringing it to my Wii. They're offering it for DS, but have you seen the screenshots? That's horrible. It's like the 80s version of Zelda or something weird like that. So, anyway, I just had to express my disappointment.
Well, you know, the DS is handheld, so they're allowed to take some graphical shortcuts.
Well, there's some liberties, and then there's, what the crap have you done to my Civ?
Well, yeah, but, I mean, Civ Rev, I guess they didn't want it to Wii, because they didn't want it to look like an 8-bit game.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they wanted it on true next-generation consoles.
Like 360.
Right.
I can't reach through here and slap Imran, damn it.
Uh-huh.
I support it. I don't care where they release it at, but again, no one's going to win. People bash the heck out of it. No matter what gets released, it's dumbed down. If the game is really hard to beat, then they say that the AI cheats. If it's real easy to beat, then the company has dumbed the game down. It's a no-win situation.
Some people just love to whine. They have to have something to whine about. If they can't whine about something, they're not happy.
That's exactly right. So I'm happy waiting a little extra time.
Got news? Email news@apolton.net or send a private message to Dan Q, Lacutus, or one of the other news editors.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
Exploring after initial expansion. Do we do it? And at what point in the game do we look to further expand after our initial settlement? I hardly ever do.
I like to send, like, a ship around the world. See if there's any little islands. Usually it's just one or two ships I like to send going around the world, looking at all the unexplored areas, see if there's any decent-sized islands with resources that have not been claimed.
At least you find out, everything's taken, at least I get the circumnavigation bonus.
Woohoo! Well, yeah, and then one I send in, like, opposite directions, one from the north side of the map, one from the south side of the map.
Yeah, and I always keep the initial explorers I have going as long as they're still alive, trying to map out the territory, and if I have to, like, squeeze through in between different countries to see places. It's better to have the idea of the map and know what your neighbors have and what you have, and if it'd be the better one to try and go conquer.
I agree with that. That's exactly what I do.
Sometimes I like to port it more on try to be a little bit more realistic, like as in, even if you have a ship and you are actually in this historical moment, you're not going to be able to know what's inland or how big that land is. I kind of like taking my chances on taking my neighbors out, expanding my territory so it's easy to reinforce and defend later on, versus if I try to take and split a territory, then if that other countries go against you, you're going to have a real time of defending it and keeping it. At least that would be my experience. Unless I'm overly powerful in military, then I would ask all comers to step up.
Yeah, we're not necessarily going after distant lands across the sea. It's just intelligence gathering in the neighbors right next door to us.
What kind of intelligence can you gather if you start out, like, in one of the early years and you happen to find the Romans, or if it's the Carthaginians or whoever it is, and then later on, as they advance, what kind of intelligence, or just looking to map out their territory?
It's mapping out their territory, knowing what resources they have. If it's the Romans and you see they don't have any iron, you know they're a great target because they can't build Praetorians.
I get you.
For me, at that point, I'd let my scouts continue to wander, probably averaging 2 to 4 a number, depending upon the map size. Do some additional observation duty. I may disband them, or I may disband them after such duty. I think more often than not, what I'll do is, if my army is continuing to grow and I'd rather use the goal to support combat units than scouts, then I'll eventually disband them. But it's always nice to have them situated somewhere in another civilization's territory that I've got open borders with, and allows me to see the comings and goings of their units, especially in their larger centers. If I'm on an island by myself or a continent by myself, I like using them, pushing them into the parts of landmass that I'm not quite ready to settle yet, and I'll put them along the coast so that way I know, hey, is someone scouting themselves for possible places to land, and perhaps even use them as future city site markers.
Barb patrol, that's the other use.
If I wanted to have an overseas port, I was thinking about what Miss Mackey was talking about earlier in the comment. And yeah, come to think of it, I had done that in some games. Pick a land that's not too far away, but still not extremely close to mine, and I'll try to find a nice port city that perhaps has a couple of adjoining cities that are fairly close. That way you can get a good landing party set up, and you could take, say, two or three cities fairly quick and then get a good toehold in on that territory, and of course then maybe make peace at a later time. Might have its merits after all, doing some exploration after the initial expansion.
Some in this thread talk about, oh, just sit back and waiting for paper to trade for AI maps. Something which I always aim to do as soon as possible, but I still like being able to explore myself as well, because by the time you can get paper and trade maps, in the way of what Imran was saying, taking his ships out, for example, and exploring other lands, by that point you may find out, oh, gee, look at that, there was something relatively nearby, and I could have had it, but I waited until I could find out whether I could have it or not, and now I can't.
That's right. I agree. It's not a guaranteed deal set in stone if you do get paper that you can get it from them, and they may want to play a hard line with you.
And even then, when I'm talking about trading for a world map, I really don't like trading my world map for their world map.
Right.
I'll give you some gold instead. I really don't like giving the AI my...
There you go.
My map. Unless, of course, we're later in the game, we actually get to satellites, for example, then, okay, sure. This was in Civ 3. Remember when you could just trade a territory map
right.
instead of a world map? I'd like to be able to trade at all but territory.
Here's everything that's outside my lands. Don't come in this dark area. Here there be dragons.
Hey, you could trade an older map. If you were able to trade an older map with them, you know, from where you are right now, say, yeah, this is all I got. Enabling wineries. That was a topic I found very interesting, and I thought it was explained well in the posts over at our fellow Civ supporter site. How do y'all think about that, that wineries are a European cultural thing? Do you think it had anything to do with the availability of clean water? That's not a barb or a so-called troll. That is a known fact about the water systems over there, and that's why a lot of them were drinking wine versus water.
Well, the history of wine, I mean, of course, you had it in Greece and Egypt and Rome. I mean, I think it's maybe just a gameplay thing. Or maybe, yeah, maybe you're right that it's kind of perceived that wineries are associated with European monarchs who like their fancy, fancy wines.
And monarchies in other places, too, but I think the other thing is that the wine is a different style of production. The other things, I mean, somebody was pointing out that there were some of the other things that are under calendar or seasonal, and some of them aren't. But with wine, it's a totally different production system, because you plant the vines once, and you're just harvesting grapes every year, and it's something different. And you have to have the casks and everything to age the wine and stuff to put the wine in, and it's not just gather it and go process it, and you're done with it. So you had to have some sort of a local structure to support that. And I guess they wanted to associate that kind of thing to monarchy, maybe. Or they just couldn't figure out else where to put it. I don't know.
I think J.D. Grimm had the best reason. He said, I say game balance allows happiness resource by following the religion path to augment the other happiness capabilities associated with it.
In a truer statement, would add a small byline to that. I think I ought to have a penalty to it as well, because society that starts living on wine may get an initial bonus for happiness or the feeling of superiority, but if they continue to drink a lot of alcohol, then they will probably take their minds off of other things they need to pay attention to. Bunch of...
That sounds like a great scenario.
The more wineries you build, the more the screen shifts and shakes.
Or, hey, you lose hit points, you lose a little bit of science. Because if you want to look at wine, look at Los Angeles. Look at some of them alleyways. They got the screwed up wine festivals of the world there, you know what I mean? Look at the kind of life that they're living.
Yeah, but you also have to remember that ancient wine wasn't as alcoholic. It was watered down a lot more.
If it was fermented, it would have been. Right, but you're right. If it wasn't fermented, then it wouldn't have been.
As far as gameplay balance goes, I like the fact that with the same technology, you can't be cultivating wineries at the same time as, like, incense, bananas, dyes, and silk. And although it wouldn't necessarily be logical, I would, in one sense, like to see, okay, wineries through monarchy, and then through calendar, maybe some of combination of incense, bananas, dye, silk, sugar, and spices being opened up, but then another technology around the same time, perhaps, being able to then okay, now that you've got this other technology, now you can also get the other combination of incense, bananas, dyes, silk, sugar, and spices. I just like saying all those in one breath. But at the same time, I recognize, well, what would you pair them up with? I'm definitely not saying, well, let's introduce just another technology that you have to get in order to be able to have those enabled, but I like the idea, anyway, of having to have multiple technologies to be able to cultivate these things. There is a balance somewhere. I think I'd like to see a little farther towards, which I think goes exactly against what the opening poster was saying.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
But Bebo says that he almost never builds courthouses, at least until the late game, and when he doesn't plan on running a state property game in which case maintenance costs are low, or when he has the organized trait for cheap courthouses, a D-double production, or in rare cases, such as extremely far cities. Why? Simply because it's not worth it. There always seems to be something more important to build. He says that he's aiming his discussion on Monarch and Emperor level, which is a difficulty level or two higher above myself at Noble, but still. Courthouses reduce maintenance by 50%, provide +2 espionage points, can turn one citizen into a spy, and is required to build the Forbidden Palace. Some of these introduced with Beyond the Sword expansion pack. The cost of a courthouse is 120 hammers and becomes available early on with the Code of Laws technology. In preface, let me echo Kzap's question, which is just how large are your empires in Civ 4, Babio? I'll also state my assumption here that I'm assuming that you're playing with Beyond the Sword, as you do mention, however dismissively, the courthouse's espionage benefits. And as everyone noticed, this was actually my favorite part of the argument, where as far as I'm concerned, he hurts his anti-courthouse position and reinforces the pro-courthouse side, which I'm happily a part of. For simplicity, I'll ignore the +2 espionage, although I suppose it could be marginally useful. We'll only look at the effect it has on the maintenance cost. What you call simplicity for dismissing +2 espionage, Babio, I call convenience for your argument. I mean, we've talked before about the espionage benefit, and I'm not going to go into the specifics of that. You say you don't use espionage until the late game either, save a great wall, great spy strategy. But I find that at first you say, well, I'm going to ignore espionage, although it could be marginally useful, except that I really don't use it personally. Your argument is turned into kind of defensive. It's kind of like, well, don't do X, though it could possibly be a little beneficial. But then again, for me, why? So, no.
We're not trying to be negative here, but especially in a higher level, it's about every coin you can scrape up for research. That two or three that you save in a few small cities, say you have 10 small cities, you save two or three a turn, that's 30 gold a turn. That's not a small amount of money, actually.
That's right. Right what Kzap said. In the end analysis, saving 3 gold is saving 3 gold. If you're in business, hey, people look for that really big lump sum. But you can also pick a few of the small customers off to make that big sum. So if you can save 3 gold, then that's 3 gold. And like you said, several cities, that'll all add up. And that's where a lot of people miss a golden opportunity. They just look for that really big savings and that big money maker or what have you, but they miss these little details. That's the part that I love about Civilization, the micromanaging and helping get these. And he's right. Maybe build it a little later on, but yes, you need to build it.
Yeah, even if you build it in an early medieval era, there's still so much of the game left for you to play, and you're going to be saving that for the whole thing, and your research is going to be faster, you'll be getting to the technologies and the new units you need faster. It's a snowball effect.
Absolutely. In a subsequent post, Fabio writes, yeah, I must admit I don't like espionage, so I don't count them. Maybe I should.
Yeah, you should.
He compares the courthouse to the library and harbors in support of his argument, as they are other, quote, buildings of the same time and are, in his view, more productive. Well, we're not exactly comparing apples and apples here. The library's purpose is towards science and harbor for trade and health, while the latter were clam, crab, or fish are available. And, of course, harbors can only be built in coastal cities where available, you know, map type and whether you have coastal access. But as you yourself say, Babio, when you are about to build a new building, quote, take a quick look at the costs and weigh your alternatives carefully. By doing so, you'll understand the mechanics of the game better and make better strategic choices, unquote, I'm agreeing with you up till that point, but then you conclude from this logic that, quote, like me, you'll probably end up building no courthouses.
No.
Unquote. What? I'm missing a few degrees of separation here. What's going on? And you say, do the math, Babio, and as Jet points out, courthouses savings are more than just as you see, for example, these three gold, whatnot, because it's multiplied by inflation. In addition to the immediate maintenance cost reductions, if, you know, empires that are expanding in number and distance, you know, at least until you get to maybe state property, decide to choose state property, if you have at least one courthouse, you can then build the Forbidden Palace, which is very advantageous because it adds another seat of government, which further reduces maintenance costs in nearby cities, not to mention, hey, plus four culture points a turn in the early to mid-game is quite welcome. And then, again, looking at Beyond the Sword, as far as the one spy, if you want to specialize your city, perhaps you want some additional espionage capabilities, especially early on in the game when your espionage building options are pretty limited. Even in smaller empires, now in Beyond the Sword, I think that's a key thing here, because I could see an argument for not building courthouses pre-Beyond the Sword, except on the higher difficulty levels. But pre-Beyond the Sword, I would argue to have it at least in your capital. Unless you have less than, what is it, 8 cities in the game. You know, even in smaller empires, from the time the courthouses are available to be built, the +2 espionage points is very beneficial. Again, when your total espion output is almost certainly to be relatively low, unless you're building the Great Wall. But there is one thing, I will agree with Babio on one point, is that there's an argument by Jet where he says that courthouses are vital because of corporations' maintenance, but corporations themselves aren't vital. So that I will agree with there. At 120 hammers, are courthouses pricey? Yes, particularly early in the game, but their benefits short and long term are worth it. Would I build a library first? Yes. Would I build a market first? Probably. It's all very situational, but just to say never building courthouses? Never say never.
I gotta say, I don't agree with his decisions about the courthouse. To paraphrase what you said, it's situational, and I agree 100%.
The HRE's unique building is the Rod House, which is just the glorified courthouse, and it is negative 75% maintenance, which I think is, you know, small bonus. So I definitely build it if you were that, so.
Whereas I will defend courthouses, I'm not going to be defending paratroopers here. How are paratroopers useful?
Hey, paratroopers were useful in Civ 2.
Yeah.
Everyone loved paratroopers in Civ 2.
First of all, we have to take a look at that. I rarely play modern era just because I just don't ever get to it in the game. But paratroopers, I have played them a couple times, and I think they're kind of fun just to drop behind the enemy lines and do a little bit of damage here and there. I kind of get a kick out of that, but that's all I do with them.
Just saying that, I guess in Civ 2 they were very useful. They've been nerfed since then.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you'd nuke a city and drop a paratrooper in.
Right.
Which you could still do in Civ 4.
Yeah, yeah.
We would work on the sort of same kind of strategy I used to use in Alpha Centauri, where you would clear out a city with either their equivalent of airplanes or helicopter things, and then you would use drop troops to drop them straight in the city and take it. Do sort of the same thing here with gunships and other things. They're useful for that, but other than that, it's kind of...
Yeah. I'd agree. It's kind of one of those, it could be a novelty, I guess.
It's a very situational unit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and I would argue it's so situational that it's effectively a novelty.
Yeah.
But it's a fun novelty. I said it's a fun novelty.
Depends on your definition of fun.
Okay.
For those wondering what we're talking about.
I don't know.
Well, that's just a given.
Touché, touché.
Things are getting chippy in here.
Paratroopers have 24 strength, 1 movement, and cost 160 hammers. They have a 25% chance to evade interception and can perform, well, paradrops at a range of 5 visible tiles unoccupied by enemy units from where they start, requiring 2 later game technologies, and practically so, rifling and flight. Now, in this thread, there was an argument by someone saying, you know, paratroopers are stronger than infantry, and they become available notably before mechanized infantry, so in that window there, I like to use them. You hit infantry with rifling, and you need both rifling and flight for paratroopers, so indeed they have potential, But, again, so limited, I would generally recommend against their use. And even where they do have use, I think there are better alternatives. And, Aliva, you said that you like to use them on occasion to hit on strategic resources?
Yeah, kind of pillage around a little bit.
Myself, I would prefer fighters or bombers to be able to do that. If paratroopers had a greater paradrop range, or they could be, say, paradropped from a ship.
Right.
It has to be from a city or a fortress. They have to be from a base.
Right.
So I suppose I could see some advantage, say, if you were on a border war and you said, hey, my opponent next door, look at that. There's a strategic resource. There's their only source of oil. There's their only source of uranium. And I can paradrop my troop in there and pillage that. Then, yes, but I'd rather be going with my fighters or bombers. I think they'll have a better chance of succeeding and surviving.
I completely agree with you. I just use them like a novelty, really. I might build, like, 3 units and that's it.
I don't think paratroopers, personally, are worth, with the exception of, like you were talking, ma'am, about pillaging resources. And I was reading some of these posts on the paratroopers, and they were talking about the movie A Bridge Too Far. And it's true. Using paratroopers to go in that deep, they have the initial surprise, but they cannot withstand the defenses that are in place. So if you're going in there strictly to, say, disrupt their economy or something like that, other than that, I don't think they're as worth it to invest a lot in there. And I believe one of you folks had mentioned building 2 or 3. That may be worth it just to kind of get the other player on edge or to be focusing in another direction. Overall, I'm going to have to say no. I don't think they're worth it.
DeBrown says that he has used paratroopers for invading not too distant islands from his own territory, and that they can be useful because they can push farther into enemy territory in a single turn than even modern armor can. But again, let's look past beyond the fact that paradropping in, again, nearby city or fortress to dispatch them from, I would rather spend my time and resources building tanks when they come around. And even before mechanized infantry come around, I'd rather just be building more infantry at that point.
Amen.
Short of being technologically superior to another civilization, and or perhaps an opponent's civilization has minimal to no fighters and hopefully no airports, I suppose that might be a situation that they could have a use, but when it comes to one movement combat units in the later game, other than mobile artillery and mobile SAMs, I think I'm more interested in Marines than paratroopers.
Yes.
Marines for their amphibious promotion from the outset.
And SEALs if you're Americans.
I am curious just about one thing with regards to multiplayer. Brian1974 says that the AI tends to keep its rear areas well garrisoned, diminishing the impact of paratroopers and commandos. But human players often economize force by concentrating their defenses near the front, and paratroopers can punish them for that. Does that ring true?
Well, I don't think I've been in the modern era in multiplayer in a while. It usually ends up getting decided before we get to paratroopers and things like that.
Unless you played on an advanced start. But
right.
Who the heck would want to do that? So, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. It's no fun.
Just reading down some of the other posts. I'm not sure exactly what it means. R Rolo 1 said, too bad we can't do forts in enemy territories or else these dudes would be OP. Outposts, or is that what I mean? That'd be pretty cool if you could do that. Say you could build an enemy fort in enemy territory if you had X amount of paratroopers. But still, I was just trying to figure out what he was talking about.
He could be referring to maybe operational.
There's a good way for competitive play and to have other people give you advice. That's the Apulgin University.
And we would find that where? Jeez.
Apulgin.net/forums?
Really? Wow. How could I figure that out from Apulgin University?
I don't know.
Sometimes I wonder.
Welcome to an interview segment where we hold conversations with key individuals in the Civ community.
On the Poly Beyond the Sword Team Democracy Game.
Beta here. I'm here to talk to you about the Poly Beyond the Sword Team Democracy Game.
We can see right in this forum, most of the threads are team setup, pull, number, whatever, whether it's from game speed or whether you're going to have vassal states or tech trading or even just the sea level and climate. Is that number of pulling, is that typical in a democracy game? And if so, has there been attempts just for whomever, say, the organizer is, to just say from the start what the settings are going to be? Or in other words, at what point do you say enough is enough? Like, I know a lot of the polls have particular cutoff times, but what do you feel personally is the balance between democracy in the democracy games and a little bit of authoritarian sort of cutoffs?
Good question. And I'll get to a little add-on on something I've learned recently in my life in Sorantium. But to directly answer your question, yeah, there's a happy medium in there somewhere. If you go back to the Warlords Pit Boss game, we had had some input into what the map was going to look like. And unfortunately, I think the map maker sort of took that and came up with a map that didn't quite meet the needs of the team. So I think what you're seeing now in the BTS Team Democracy game is the reaction to that, to make sure that everybody's on side with what the map is going to look like, so no one can say 2 months down the road, well, gee, this is the map we agreed to, or this is not what the game I thought we were playing. Do we need to have as many polls as we've got? Hats off to Rob for coordinating the way he does. It does make it a bit tedious. Like I say, pat in the back to him for going through it all. But on the other hand, it does sort of dot every I and cross every T in terms of what the map is going to look like and what game we're playing. Yeah, maybe some of the lesser stuff we could have sidestepped and just said somebody make the obvious choice. But, you know, we were working towards the next patch in terms of timing. So we weren't necessarily in a rush to get this game started, which is why I think Rob was taking the time to make sure the map was done properly. My little add-on as to too much democracy in a democracy game, Sorantium, and I'm revealing a bit of internal secrets here of the Sorantium team from the play-by-email Warlords game. I tend to be the team leader, the team player, and we had a poll as to which way we wanted to take, and I disagreed with the team and played the turn differently and made different decisions and contacted other teams with the way I thought we should be doing things. And Unorthodox knows about this. And it got me into real hot trouble with my teammates. And I had a lot of crow I had to eat, and I had to make my sincere apologies at a personal level to members of the team. And it kind of was a valuable lesson to me. This is more than a game, that the people invest a fair bit of time and effort in this, and you have to respect the democracy of a democracy game. That's what they're about. And they say it just takes civilization to a whole different level of human interaction that makes it the interesting and exciting game that it is.
Considerations of unique units more important than, say, considerations of unique buildings?
Good question. I would suggest, yeah, they're probably about equal. They very much are second tier after the traits and the starting technologies. So if I was to put them in the list of what teams generally look to, is first the two traits, second would be the two starting techs, and then third would likely be the unique unit, unique building. Now, when I say that they fall after the two starting techs, that's quite often because of teams like ours, which I mentioned the Templars earlier, which has a religious bent. We're looking to, you know, should we have a civilization that starts with mysticism, so to get us on a fast track to a religion? Or do we let the others discover them and we fight for them? So I would say the unique unit, the unique building, it's there, it's part of the discussion, but it definitely is not as important as the others.
Am I assumption correct that you don't necessarily get into the modern age that often?
It's a good point, and quite often, you know, something happens military or diplomatically earlier than that, that they never reach that final conclusion. So I always think of the old Civ 3 and the modern jet fighter, which as American, you probably would never ever see in a democracy game. And hence, I think, because the early days in democracy games is when the interest is highest and civilizations are most vulnerable. That's why perhaps my bias here is the fact that those early unique units are sometimes the most valuable in the game. My only other experience, I think back to what I mentioned earlier about Vox Controlli versus Gathering Storm, and that's where we had the Persians and the good old 4-2 Immortals coming down. Speaking of which, our attack on Gathering Storm was key named Immortal Beloved. But there was a point where that one unit, the Immortal, kind of said, well, if we're ever going to take advantage of this unique unit, we better attack now, because it's over time its advantage is going to decrease. So in that respect, the attack was somewhat triggered by a unique unit and its approaching its path. Due date, so to speak.
I know there was discussion about having a Polton set up Pit Boss, and unfortunately, you need a system that runs Windows for that, and our system runs Linux. Hopefully, there'll be some time that there'll be a Pit Boss version that's in Linux and that we could actually set that up, because then I know that would, I think, right, Beta, that would help alleviate a lot of some concerns as far as setups go.
I yes and no. I don't, having hosted a Pit Boss game now for the last year and a half, which basically means you have to have your computer on 24/7, to me it's not a big issue, and there's no advantage. Like me being a member of the Templars and hosting the game on my computer, I no way I can access the game to get any information that I couldn't get just as being a member of the Templars. So Yeah, it would be nice if Palton had the facility to run Pit Boss games and we had a site where we could host them. But to me, it's not overly critical. I think there's enough individuals with computer setups and reliable hookups that we can host the games for now. What it does create a little bit of a complication is sometime if you are hosting the game and you're one of the teams that eliminate it, your interest level in that game goes down. But that's life. And to the credit, people have continued to host the games even after they've been eliminated.
So when you're playing one democracy game, like if you're playing the turns for one democracy game, are you thinking about another one at the same time?
Oh, always. Like I say, right now I'm involved in two democracy games, and this one starting up will be the third. And yeah, then I'll be actively involved in all of them. And it's great fun, and I wouldn't be that heavily involved if I didn't enjoy it. It's an issue that always comes up, is that fine line between when people are being serious and where role play kick in. And it's something that has to be managed carefully, because as I found out early, you can go a bit too far with it.
I remember reading some of that too. It was like, whoa, taking the game a little too seriously, people.
Yeah. And it's a point where then it took me up to 6 months after that experience to actually go and have to apologize to people and explain why we did what we did. And it could have been just the folks in Gathering Storm and Barkley and those guys wanted a good logical reason as to why we attacked. And, you know, the reason we attacked was we felt we had no other choice in the situation in the game. And it had nothing to do with the fact that they were planning to attack us or that, you know, there was border tension, none of which was true. Different teams approach the game differently, and role-play means different things to different people, and you got to be careful about it. The other thing to note is that the democracy games quite often go beyond Apolitan, where we've had inter-site democracy games. We've had, there was one in Civ 3, and there was an earlier one in Civ 4. I have to be honest with you, I've lost track of where it is. Big Free was playing our turns. And it gets to another point that is always an issue with democracy games, is that particularly the play-by-email games, which can drag on in terms of time, and what becomes critical then is trying to maintain that level of interest with that many players over that length of time. And unless the game moves quickly and maintains some sort of sense of reliability, it's easy to lose players. And that's where I think Pit Boss is such a brilliant, brilliant form for the games. And with a good host, this should make the new game coming up a great success.
Excellent. Thank you for the information.
My pleasure.
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future.
Making colony sensible. Have I ever made a colony? I don't even know.
I haven't.
I haven't either.
Nick 1984 has a post saying Eureka. Well, I added Eureka. But basically, I got it. I know how to make colonies sensible. He wants to include something, cede military control, where a vassal may give the master military control over his units. Colonies would start with this deal being active. The master may upgrade the units he controls in the vassal cities, even if the vassal doesn't have the technology, while paying the vassal unit upgrades from his own pocket.
In a later post, he appends saying maybe the number of units you control might be limited, so that you cannot move the last unit out of a vassal city.
That's probably a good idea.
And then reaffirms that you don't control really any non-combat unit.
Oh.
I don't see the great advantage in ceding military control, and may have its ups and downs, but I don't personally see the need for it.
This Bob San detailed suggestion about a recruiter unit that would let you draft the unit from larger colonial cities instead. So you send the recruiters over to your colony, use the special, and the drafting consumes one population and run recruiter. And the new unit is whatever your colony's current infantry is, meaning if they have muskets and you have rifles, they become a musket. And the unit can then be settled back into the city. With regards to both the recruiter unit and the seed military control, I'm not liking either of those suggestions.
Well, there's also seed voting proxy was suggested. Something, I guess, Mike 1984 said was in Smack, where you would cast your vassals' votes in exchange for whatever.
I do like that idea, but the ceding military control just seems to be a bit too micromanagey for me. What I do like is, not that I necessarily like the form handle, kill me pleases option.
Oh, no.
I think there must be a trade units option in the diplomatic screen, so you can trade units or demand them as tribute. This unit's supply becomes your units, and you can do with them with what you want, but they become enemy units when war is declared against their former country and withdraw beyond the borders. I'm not necessarily certain about the latter part. Maybe these take into gameplay balance versus realism consideration. But I prefer something through the diplomacy screen rather than just this seeding military control or, in my opinion, even less desirable, a recruiter unit. We have enough units.
Well, it seems to bring a sort of a historical idea of feudal levies, where it lets the vassal raise a levy for the master of a certain amount of units for the master while war. But I don't know about gameplay.
That sounds interesting, though. I don't have as great an objection to it myself.
Why is that?
I don't know. It sounds cool.
Why? What's so cool about it?
You cede military control. Offer them something in return for it for a few turns.
Well,
I wouldn't necessarily want it to be as easy as, say, they state it, but I think if it was something that required a bit more, I mean, it might be somewhat useful.
Well, since this would be from a master to a vassal,
yeah,
the master shouldn't have to give up anything to the vassal. They just demand it.
Well,
as part of the deal. If they don't like it, then I guess they're no longer the vassal. They've declared war. They're not going to cede their military control.
Well, you could have that, the way he has it is kind of a negotiable deal.
A negotiable deal? How so? Why would the master have to negotiate anything? They just say, hey, we want you to cede military control.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at polycast@apolton.net.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling show Modcast, or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at polycast.apolton.net.
Running the empire here into the real world, do you think your management would be successful, or do you think that you would actually fall apart?
My empire would be extremely exciting.
Oh.
See, my people have a great love of pachyderms, and as such, each major military city sports a fine pair of war elephants as a city mascot. As they are sacred animals, they rarely tread the war path, and every morning we sing our national anthem. You may know it.
Hold on, I'm getting some feedback in my ears. What was that? Sorry.
You missed it, buddy. That's it.
Did you say in your city you have taxidermists? What's that got to do with elephants?
No, we have pachyderms.
This is what's going to happen. If you don't perform in the field, Mr. Elephant, you're going to be seeing him.
Oh.
I'm going to stuff you.
Oh, don't say things like that to Mr. Snuffles.
Mr. Snuffles.
And Mr. Trapples.
Thank you for joining us on episode 43 of Polycast and official podcast of Polton Civilization Site. I was Imran Siddiqui, and I still am, joined by Dan Q.
Hello, and goodbye.
Kartumandwa, also known as Annalie.
Hasta luego.
Makalua.
Bye.
And our old friend, Grandpa Troll, Bruce.
Thank you for inviting me back. It's good to be back among friends and family, and it was my pleasure.
Didn't play a lot of Smack. Is that true?
I don't remember.
Been so long for me.
It sounds right. I don't know.
Is that true, Mackie?
It's been a while. I don't remember either.
Do you suppose it's because the Europeans are not as scientifically advanced as the North Americans?
All hate mail. Do we still have hate mail?
Do we ever get hate mail?
Well, in that case, I'll just unmute and start posting a little bit.
And that would be different from normal now.
Oh, yeah, wait. Never mind.
You know what can make colonies more sensible? If we just used more smileys.
We weren't just playing with smileys, really.
I know, really. Who sits around the computer listening to podcasts every week?
I do. Yeah.
But not with your family.
Hey, honey, listen to this.
Record date?
April 26, 2008.
Sound clips copyright of Civ 4, The Warlords, and Beyond the Sword expansion packs. Copyright 2008, Appleton Civilization site at appleton.net.